The following program is made possible by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
If the people of this country should elect me, I shall continue to serve them in the office I now hold.
And the Vice President seems to sail downwind, no matter which way the wind blows.
There is no political campaign that justifies the declaration of a moratorium on common sense.
It was this implicit faith and trust in Eisenhower as a man of goodness that made him utterly impossible to defeat.
He was the unbeatable.
The Eisenhower Years, a chronicle in sound of the life of Dwight Eisenhower, produced by Extension Radio Television at Kansas State University. This week, the President and Politics.
On September 24th, 1955, the nation was brought up short by bulletins on radio and television.
Betsy gave out, and down in the sand she lay rolling about.
We interrupt the Kansas story for this bulletin from the KSAC newsroom. The White House has just announced that President Eisenhower has suffered what is described as a mild heart attack. The announcement came from Press Secretary James Hagerty, who said the president has been hospitalized at Fitzsimmons General Hospital in Denver.
Ike and Mamie had been vacationing in Denver. The attack came during the night. Ike's personal physician, General Howard Snyder, was immediately called. He diagnosed a heart attack. The next morning, an electrocardiogram confirmed that. Ike was taken to Fitzsimmons General Hospital, Denver. The first announcement described the ailment as a mild heart attack. That was later changed to moderate. And now the nation waited, listened to the medical reports, and prayed. But Ike's recovery was rapid. Within a short time, Eisenhower was seeing officials and writing reports from his hospital bed in Denver. Within a few weeks, he was walking and exercising, was photographed wearing those bright red pajamas given him by the press corps. On the pocket were five stars and the words, "Much better, thanks." And on November 11th, he was released from the hospital and returned to Washington. His doctors said he was normal again, only that he must not get fatigued and must watch his weight. That meant giving up some of his favorite Eisenhower-cooked dishes. Now, the question on everyone's mind, would Ike run for a second term? He considered, and on the last day of February in 1956, made the announcement to the nation.
My fellow citizens, I wanted to come into your homes this evening because I feel the need of talking with you directly about a decision I made today after weeks of the most careful and devoutly prayerful consideration. I have decided that if the Republican Party chooses to renominate me, I shall accept that nomination.
It was official. Ike was a candidate. And there was never any question but what he would be nominated and that he probably would get his second term. So Eisenhower sat out the primaries. But his 1952 Democratic opponent, Adlai Stevenson, was locked in a struggle in the Democratic primaries with Senator Estes Kefauver. Stevenson, who had not wanted the nomination in 52, was determined to get it in 56. Biographer Kenneth S. Davis, a one-time Stevenson speechwriter, says Stevenson was disillusioned after that 52 campaign.
I know that the governor, Adlai Stevenson, was very disillusioned with Eisenhower. In 52, he had really been... sort of thought that, you know, Truman had it, that the party was getting a little corrupt. There was a lot of, the Kefauver investigation was on, and there were a lot of evidences of the Democratic machines being allied with gangsters and crime. And I think, in fact, I know that Stevenson thought it might be best for the country to have, if the Republicans would run a good man, not Taft, you know, no isolationist, but an internationalist who was a liberal, fairly liberal, and he thought Ike was a good man. But he was very swiftly disillusioned in the 52 campaign. But I was astonished that he didn't do better in 56. He didn't run the campaign well in 56. It wasn't as good, as well run a campaign for some reason in 56. I've never quite understood what went wrong. Well, I do know what went wrong in a sense. He had to fight this terrific primary battle for almost a year before the convention, and he was pretty well used up, whether he knew it or not, you know, mentally and emotionally. And he didn't look good during the 56 campaign. It didn't have the verve that he had in 52 or 54.
But before either Stevenson or Eisenhower were nominated, an event on the world scene erupted that would play a large role in public attitude on Election Day. On July 26th, Egypt's President Nasser seized control of the Suez Canal. Instantly, Britain and France reacted, threatened to take the canal back by force. British Prime Minister Anthony Eden issued the warning.
If Colonel Nasser's action were to succeed, each one of us would be at the mercy of one man for the supplies upon which we live. We could never accept that. With dictators, you always have to pay a higher price later on, for their appetite grows with feeding.
Eden stressed that Britain would use force only at the last resort to ensure international use of the canal. Secretary of State Dulles conferred with British and French officials, and on August 16th, a 22-nation conference on the canal was called in London. That same day in Chicago, Adlai Stevenson was nominated as the Democratic presidential standard-bearer. His running mate, his primary foe, Senator Estes Kefauver.
4 years ago, I did not seek the honor that you bestowed upon me. This time, as you may have noticed, it was not entirely unsolicited. And there's another big difference. That time we lost, this time we will win.
A week later in San Francisco, Ike was unanimously nominated as the GOP standard bearer, and Richard Nixon was again his running mate. But there had been some pre-convention attempts to dump him. Columnist Roscoe Drummond on the Eisenhower-Nixon relationship.
I don't think they were very close. I don't think there were two different types of personality. Here's Nixon, the very texture of his skin and blood is political. And here's Ike, who is positively disinterested in politics. And I think that he recognized that Nixon had a good mind. He has said, and I've heard him say, that there wasn't anybody in the cabinet who did a better job of summing up the arguments pro and con that had been brought out on an issue than Nixon was. But I don't think there was any very much of a warm personal relationship between them, and I would suspect that Eisenhower in 1956 was probably quite open-minded as to whether or not Nixon would necessarily be the ideal running mate. You know, there was Stassen tried to dump Nixon, and Stassen was in the administration, and Sherman Adams wasn't above planting an idea now and then that maybe Nixon would serve his own best interest if he didn't run but took a cabinet position. I think I deliberately let all this go on, not feeling, well, he's my boy and I want him above everything else.
In Ike's acceptance speech, he told the story of a new arrival in Washington who saw a motto on a public building which read, "What is past is prologue." The fellow asked his cab driver what that meant.
"Oh, that," said the driver, "that's just bureaucrat talk. What it really means is, you ain't seen nothing yet."
The campaign was on. Stevenson the attacker, Ike the defender. Issues included foreign policy, public versus private power, and Ike's health.
"Everyone shares in the sympathy for the circumstances which have created a part-time presidency. But we cannot understand, and we will not accept, turning the government over to men who work full-time for the wrong people or for a limited group of people. And the plain truth is that this situation would get worse, not better, because what influence the president has with the Republican leaders in Congress has depended on his running again. But from here on, the future of Republican leaders will depend not on Mr. Eisenhower, but the Republican heir apparent, Mr. Nixon. And the vice president seems to sail downwind, no matter which way the wind blows.
Stevenson raised the issue of nuclear fallout, called for an end to atmospheric testing of nuclear bombs. Ike answered.
They urge a vigorous and realistic policy towards a communist empire, and they suggest that we begin in our relations with the Soviet Union by trusting our national safety to agreements that have no effective safeguards and no controls. They urge a bold American defense of freedom, and they urge us to try achieving this by starting to plan to end our military draft. I respond to such propositions with one firm belief. There is no political campaign that justifies the declaration of a moratorium on common sense.
Interestingly enough, Ike himself would suggest an end to atmospheric testing 2 years later. Stevenson remained on the attack. Ike seemed content with defending his presidential record of peace and prosperity.
He never delivered an off-the-cuff campaign speech with very much substance. He didn't campaign on the basis of his intellectual greatness. He campaigned on the man that he was. And I think that he really didn't have to think much what the nation would feel or want. He embodied the nation, in my experience. And I can remember watching him with crowds, and the warmth and trust and affection for that man would just well up from people along the street or from audiences.
Just 2 weeks before the election, world events again grabbed the headlines. On October 24th, rioting and anti-Soviet demonstrations began in Budapest, Hungary. And on the 29th, the Israeli army invaded Egypt's Sinai Peninsula. On the 31st, the British and French began aerial bombardments of Egyptian airfields and other military targets. Ike spoke to the nation, said the U.S. would not get involved militarily in the Mideast, but denounced the attack on Israel. On November 5th, British and French paratroopers and commandos landed at Port Said and Port Fuad in Egypt. The Suez Crisis served to further solidify the American people behind President Eisenhower. Kenneth Davis.
I think Stevenson might conceivably have beaten him in 56 with a somewhat different campaign. He was coming up very, very fast. He really was. People forget this. But the polls were beginning to reflect it until this Suez Crisis, you know, this really wrecked him just a week before the election. And the Suez Crisis was Ike's fault as much as anybody's. I mean, this Dulles policy, first you build up Nasser, and then after Nasser's built up and Israel's scared stiff and Britain's scared stiff about because they're going to lose Suez Canal, then the thing blows up, and then he gets all the credit for being the great white father who's going to save us from a situation for which he was responsible. But I don't think Stevenson would have won anyway, but without that, I think it's possible he might have. If he had come out swinging on Suez when his instinct told him he should, which was in August or July, but he didn't, so that when he did give a great speech, one of the greatest speeches of that campaign. In fact, I think about the best was on the Suez Crisis, in which he traced its genesis and just what was done wrong, one error after another by the Eisenhower administration.
I thought that he was right in principle in opposing the attack on Egypt by France, Israel, and Great Britain. I can't see any American Secretary of State being an ally of the military attack. So I thought that Dulles was right on that. I do think that in the end, Dulles came to have second thoughts on the Aswan Dam decision. I think he made the decision on too narrow a basis, probably, in retrospect. Namely, on the basis of whether or not the Egyptian economy and the Egyptian currency could stand to carry out its end of what it was attempting to undertake. And I don't know what the premises should have been bigger than that. And I have heard it said, but I never got it direct from Dulles, that one thing that he felt was a mistake was that decision.
When the votes were tallied on November 6th, Ike had racked up the largest popular vote in history to that time, 35.5 million votes, 457 electoral votes to Stevenson's 73.
The majority in 1956 was overwhelming, something I think over 9 million votes a majority. But at the same time, we lost both the Congress and the Senate. And I have come to this conclusion that our people have matured somewhat in their voting habit and in their political thinking. I honestly believe that they make a difference in their minds of the kind of man they want as the national leader, their president, and they do the man that is going to represent them in localities, the districts and the states. What I think is that this is the mental picture each American has of the man that he sees publicized either in the on the television screen or in the newspapers or in any other way.
I think he was a kind of mirror in which the common man could see himself reflected in the colors and shapes of greatness, you see, which of course is nice. I think heroes in general are that way. Everybody identifies with a hero and thinks of himself in terms, the hero is himself in a sense. But he was a special kind of hero.
He fit in the Saturday Evening Post type of Norman Rockwell kind of American boy. He really was fitted perfectly. Also, he had a great publicity, naturally. He was, I don't know how much of it was Ike and how much it was his image. In fact, though I think the image was a fairly accurate reflection of it.
The single foremost quality of President Eisenhower's public life was this element of trust that people had in him. The key to a man's public life is when people trust you. That is a quality that exceeds every other one. And President Eisenhower had that quality. I saw it in my mother, in her reaction to him. I'd hear from her once in a while, and she always liked President Eisenhower. Well, now, the reason I'm telling you this is that lots of the so-called unsophisticated people in America, they call them unsophisticated, they're really, the, in many ways, the strength of this nation, they just liked him. They didn't know anything about his politics. And he had that friendly smile, that kind of informal manner about him, which endeared him to a lot of people and gained him a great deal of respect and affection. I think there was trust, affection, and respect even beyond admiration. I mean, you admire sometimes some people but don't particularly like them. And but the people respected him, and they held him in warm affection and basically in trust.
He had something which few presidents have had, the absolute, implicit, abiding trust of the American people. They just figure, I can make a mistake, but he couldn't do anything evil.
Of a certain kind of politics, he was an absolute genius. The politics of popularity, for instance, he knew exactly what impression he was producing on people at almost every moment.
It's often said that President Eisenhower really wasn't much of a politician. Well, that just depends on what you mean by politician. Would that I had the political attraction that he had. They could call me any kind of a name they wanted to, because he was undoubtedly one of the most popular political figures in American life.
It was this implicit faith and trust in Eisenhower as a man of goodness that made him utterly impossible to defeat.
He was the unbeatable.
Ike, then, immensely popular with the people. But what brand of politician was he? He himself scorned the labels of liberal or conservative. In dealing with problems and issues, he would do whatever he deemed proper at the time, based on his philosophy and what he considered to be good for the nation. His domestic policy was described as dynamic conservatism, based on private enterprise, personal incentive, fewer government controls, and a balanced budget. His foreign policy moved from unyielding communist containment to the spirit of Camp David. And although partisan in his support of Republican doctrine, Ike didn't care for the practice of partisan politics. The late Senator Everett Dirksen.
I don't believe you could rank Eisenhower as a part of the political breed. He had been in the military so long, and it did not come to him naturally. That is a certainty, insofar as I know. And I can base it, if on nothing else, on my efforts with him, month in and month out, to accept meetings of a strictly political partisan character. At that time, I was a chairman of the Republican National Senatorial Campaign Committee. And we had a standing date of one breakfast every month for that purpose. And I always had a list. Now, I said, here is a meeting you should take. Yes, but he said, it's just strictly partisan. And I don't like meetings of that kind. Now, why don't you find me something else? Well, I said, here's a Jefferson dedication. Well, he says, now that's something that I would like. Because then I don't have to somehow adhere entirely to a political note.
He had a kind of a copybook cliche concept of politics as kind of being kind of dirty. He didn't want to get messed up in politics when politics is the way we govern a democratic nation. And there are instances when legislation hung in the balance in which I always felt that there were things the president could have done which he didn't do. And this now reminds me of one of what I have always thought was, along with many strengths, was one of his principal weaknesses, and that is he hoarded his popularity instead of expending it. He always wanted to be the president above the battle. And sometimes you've got to be in the midst of the battle to accomplish what you want. And I think there are instances, there are more than a few instances in which if Eisenhower had been willing to lose some of his popularity, some of his prestige in a good cause, maybe he would accomplish something that he didn't otherwise accomplish.
He didn't have what I thought was a strong legislative leadership. President Eisenhower presented a program, and that was more or less it. He depended on his friends in the Congress to deliver, and quite frankly, the people that delivered most for him were the Democrats.
For 6 years, I had a Congress controlled by the other party. So naturally, everything I got done, I had to do by negotiation and almost abusing of every kind of persuasive thing you could possibly could.
Sam Rayburn and Lyndon Johnson were really close friends of President Eisenhower. The president understood where the power was in the Senate. There's no doubt about that. He understood that very well, and he worked with, in the Congress, understood where the power was. He worked with Rayburn. He worked with Lyndon Johnson.
Matter of fact, all three of us, fortunately, are from Texas. I was born in Texas. Sam Rayburn was in Texas. Lyndon Johnson was from Texas. I used to get the two of them in alone in the evening, and we would, over a highball or something, we would talk about the affairs of the country. And as long as I could convince them that something I was doing was non-political in its effect on the government, usually I could get them to go along. Now, of course, if they thought that it was, had a suspicion that it was going to help the Republicans more than the Democrats, then it was a different story.
I don't think he ever had as much faith in William Noland as he had in Lyndon Johnson. When I say faith, I mean he recognized that Johnson really ran the Senate. I don't think he ever felt that he could do as much with Joe Martin or with Halleck as he could with Sam Rayburn and John McCormick. So he had a kind of a bipartisan relationship there with certain key members of the Congress of the United States.
That's what I had to do all the time from every behind the scenes all the time. I couldn't get out and pound the desk because that would have just divorced all of them from me.
Eisenhower critics say he relied too heavily on his staff system, the cabinet and national security, that they interfered with presidential decision-making.
Well, he was a great committee man. He liked to have a committee and get a consensus, and then whatever the consensus was, that was it. This makes for, for bad decision-making, and you've got to get all the advice you can. But Harry Truman was very different. You know that famous remark of his, the buck stops here. Well, the buck never stopped with Ike. He passed it on. Time and again he passed it on.
I doubt that he really tended to all the details of the presidency like a Truman or a Johnson would. He was a trained military man, and he had staff organization, and he depended a great deal on staff organization. He's often criticized by those of us who are in public life of not attending to all the duties of the job, the little things. I think that is really a false criticism when I look back on it, because if you tend to every little duty, you don't have any time to tend to the big ones. And he did rely a great deal on staff.
He wanted greater independence of initiative to be taken by the cabinet. But in my judgment, in my observation, the idea that he sat around and just said, well, you boys get together and work this out, I don't think that reflects the reality. He used the cabinet and the National Security Council in a much more orderly way, in a much more consistent way than probably either JFK or LBJ, who had their own personal way of operating. I do not attach a great deal of importance to the mechanical devices of how you run the presidency. I'm more concerned with what comes out at the end, and I think that some methods suit one president and some methods suit another. The idea of presidential style seems to me to be fundamentally trivial and irrelevant. I'm much more interested in presidential substance.
As far as the making of decisions was, my training had prepared me beautifully for the presidency, because that's what you had to do. With all the facts in front of you, all the analyses they can make, all the recommendations you can get, now you have to do it.
He would participate vigorously in a discussion on a particular item. He would listen to all points of view, and then normally, right then and there, he would say, well, I think we'll do it this way. Once in a while, he would use a favorite expression and say, well, I'm not going to shoot from the hip on this one, or I'm going to sleep on this one. And that meant that we would get the decision typically the next day. But I think people do have the impression that it was difficult for him to be decisive. I certainly never experienced that.
The staff system has just one purpose, and that is to study and analyze the problem and present it before the man who has to make decisions. But the staff system is in itself no impediment.
We postponed decisions and we missed opportunity after opportunity for greatness. I can never say Eisenhower made any decisions.
I found him ready and willing to listen to all sides of an issue, and then ready and willing to make a decision. I thought of him as a decisive personality or decisive type of administrator.
As 1956 drew to a close, the situation in the Mideast remained tense. It would continue in 57. The Soviets had quelled the Hungarian revolt. The United States had refused help despite earlier Dulles speeches admonishing enslaved nations to throw off their bonds. Ike had weathered 4 years in the White House, another campaign and election, and was ready for four more.
You, Dwight D. Eisenhower, do solemnly swear...
I, Dwight D. Eisenhower, do solemnly swear...
...that you will faithfully execute the office of President...
The Eisenhower Years, produced by Extension Radio Television at Kansas State University on a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The producer-narrator is Ralph Titus. Research by Anne Frank. Music for the Eisenhower Years was composed by Gail Kubik, performed by the Kansas State University Chamber Symphony, conducted by Luther Levengood. Our thanks to WFLN Radio, Philadelphia, Metro Media Incorporated, National Educational Television, and the Eisenhower Presidential Library for providing materials used in this week's broadcast. Next week, the White House Years, the Second Term. This is Paul DeWeese. This is the National Educational Radio Network.